It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pittsburgh is often talked about in dualities, old Pittsburgh, new Pittsburgh, but how do we bring communities together to create a city that is better for all? Majestic Lane is the deputy chief of staff to Mayor Bill Peduto, and he's also the acting chief urban affairs officer for the city, and he focuses on trying to answer that very question. Majestic Lane, welcome to the Confluence.
Thank you, Kevin. Appreciate it.
The city's always taken pride in its neighborhoods, 90 neighborhoods comprising one city. How do you ensure that one or two or even a dozen or more are not left behind?
Well, I think first it's about understanding what neighborhoods really are. And neighborhoods are a confluence of people and place. They're the places that things are happening, but they're the people that things are happening to. So it's really about understanding the diversity and the depth of people in our city across the board, and then figuring out what are unique needs that all neighborhoods have, because all neighborhoods are different. I mean, we all are one Pittsburgh, but we all have different needs because of different things. So it's really trying to figure out what those things are, then how do we really get to the pulse of what those things mean, and then what are the short-term and long-term things that we can do to help resolve those issues and help make every neighborhood better.
Those differences, I mean, they can make us better as a whole, bringing something to it. But does it also, do those differences sort of make it a challenge to trying to empower everybody?
Well, yes. I mean, it goes without saying. I mean, Pittsburgh is one of the most segregated cities in America. So you often have differences in quality of life and quality of life outcomes from one part of a city to another. Mm-hmm. So it's just recognizing that. I mean, we have a diversity which makes you want to be here, from the east to the north to the south to the west, but you also have some of the differences in the quality of life determinants that you don't want to have. You want to have the similar quality of life across the city, and that goes into infrastructure, that goes into what's happening in economic development, and all those different kind of things that you want to have an impact on.
How much of a factor is organization? Let's face it, some neighborhoods have strong and several development groups. Others, maybe none at all.
It makes a big difference. I mean, that's part of how Pittsburgh has flourished where other Rust Belt cities haven't. And it was due to the impact of the community-based organizations and the community development corporation. So that's a huge part of what makes our city our city. But also now we do have a situation where there can be a tale of two cities, even as far as CDCs and CBOs in the neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. So what we're looking at is how do you try to make sure that regardless of if a neighborhood has those things, that still we can get the resources to the neighborhood. And if that's working with a council person or working with a state representative or working with a state senator or working with a faith-based organization, regardless, every neighborhood deserves the same things.
What is your approach? To you, what does neighborhood empowerment entail?
Neighborhood empowerment entails empowering people. It means creating pathways of opportunity. It means giving space for people to be able to express themselves and bring the best of themselves to our city and to our neighborhoods, and actually being able to come together. Because neighborhoods that are connected are stronger neighborhoods, just like cities that are connected and people that are connected are stronger. So really empowering neighborhoods, empowering people, and giving pathways for growth and pathways for togetherness.
Tangibly, how does that manifest itself?
So tangibly, it manifests itself by, you know, our Office of Community Affairs going out to almost every neighborhood in the city to talk about what the city is doing, to listen to concerns. It means when we're doing our capital budget to go to all aspects of all neighborhoods in the city and talk about, here's where our capital budget is, what are the concerns in your part of town. It means when people come downtown for meetings. It means when we do economic development, and you know the Urban Redevelopment Authority does economic development and takes feedback. All those things are part of neighborhood empowerment because they're all listening to the concerns of people. The mayor often says, if it's not for all of us, it's not for any of us. So it's really figuring out how do we have an ear, and then how do we turn that ear into public policy and programs that can benefit people.
I want to talk a little bit more about engaging the community. You talked about going into the community, attending meetings, et cetera, et cetera. Are there any informal approaches that you take? Maybe you just sort of wander around the neighborhood, just sort of getting a grasp of what is really going on, maybe not at those formal meetings.
Yeah, I think if you want to know a neighborhood, there are a couple things that you do. One, you go to eat at a restaurant in a neighborhood. You know, you take off the suit and take off, you know, kind of the formal clothes and just go in and act as an observer and identify how the neighborhood breathes, so to speak, how it functions, and acknowledge that all neighborhoods have strengths and opportunities. And so whether you do that, or another way, if you really want to see a neighborhood, is actually catch a bus through a neighborhood, because then you're having an experience that a lot of people are having that often goes unheard as far as, you know, transit mobility and such.
Okay. What do you do when you encounter skepticism, maybe even mistrust, such as when it's a neighborhood that's been maybe adversely affected by gentrification, or even, say, Hazelwood, to make sure that Hazelwood does feel it's truly connected to the Hazelwood Green Initiative? What's your approach when you encounter that skepticism? What is government doing?
Well, I think it's to listen, and then also to be clear about what we are doing. Often, a lot of the good things that government does to help people doesn't go heard. I mean, it does, you know, those don't really get the likes on social media. So it's really about getting messages to people, connecting with stakeholders, and then also showing people tangible things that are happening. I mean, people respond to tangible things when a park is redone, when a spray park is done, when a street is repaved. I mean, you know, it does get down to brass tacks, if you will, about those kind of things. Right. And those show that, you know, what government is doing actually is improving the quality of your life.
I mentioned gentrification. I mean, it's an issue that some neighborhoods have struggled with most recently, and maybe most publicly, Lawrenceville, East Liberty. How do we find a balance between improving spaces and not abandoning the people that already live in these places and making them feel empowered to be part of this community that they've been a part of?
I think it's that, you know, finding those pathways of opportunity. It's about really looking at the health of a neighborhood, and the health of a neighborhood is really the health of people, and identifying where people are having successes and where they're having challenges, and then where can government, where can faith-based organizations, where can philanthropy, where can people get in to be able to help and assist where people need assistance, and then also, where can you lift people up so they can do the things that they want to do and kind of do it organically? Because often you find in neighborhoods that are affected by gentrification or neighborhood change is that people haven't had the assistance to be able to create the organic change they want to create. And then now government or now businesses are coming in to do things to them instead of with them. So I think really a part of it is identifying what are the presenting factors that are not allowing people to stay in a neighborhood, and what are the presenting factors that affect what I call psychic gentrification, which is the idea of not belonging, even if you're still physically there, that you don't belong to the neighborhood, and what kind of activities can we all do to increase that psychic belonging?
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. We're speaking with Majestic Lane. He's Deputy Chief of Staff in the Peduto administration, and he's the Acting Chief Urban Affairs Officer. Pittsburgh often highlighted on most livable city list. A 2018 survey from the University of Pittsburgh, I believe your alma mater,
yes,
found perceptions of quality of life vary based on race, and with African Americans reporting lower satisfaction. You mentioned before about a divided city. How are race and place intertwined in Pittsburgh, though?
Race and place are, you can extract them here. I mean, one, I would argue that the differences in how people perceive cities along the lines of race is an American issue and frankly a global issue. But specifically in Pittsburgh, it's because the perception and the reality of the access to the things that are important to people, the quality of life indicators, they are different. I mean, and the research has shown over and over again that those things are different, quality schools, quality businesses. So it is a real thing. And I think one of the things that we're trying to do is actually deal with that head on. I mean, part of the conversation has been around neighborhoods, but you can't use neighborhoods as a substitution for race because, you know, we don't just have a place problem, we have a race problem. And we have to all engage that and acknowledge that to be able to start figuring it out. We can't ignore it.
Right. We have 2 minutes left. Does the city have to make an additional effort to empower communities of color?
Yes. The city has to make an additional effort to empower communities of color by empowering people of color, by providing access to opportunity, by providing access to listen, to providing access to the resources that allow people to flourish and feel like they are comfortable in the city that they're in so they don't leave.
Mm-hmm. So how do we make sure that Pittsburgh is advancing equity, diversity, and inclusion for all people?
Well, one, we have to keep it as part of our conversation and dialogue. We can't let it go, and we can't subsume it sometime in conversations about neighborhoods. We have to be clear about what it's about and then hold everyone accountable to what we can do to actually improve the outcomes for all people, because stronger communities of any race make a stronger city.
How do national movements for equity, for equality impact your work?
In really important ways. One of the organizations that we're working with is the Government Alliance for Racial Equity. Mm-hmm. And it's an organization started out of some folks in Seattle, but really looking at what role do institutions, governmental institutions, play in being able to foster equity. Right. So it's slightly different than more of an advocacy concept. But really, what does government do and how can government use its vast resources to actually move the needle for people in real ways?
In a sentence or two, where do you hope the city is in 10 to 15 years?
I hope we're no longer having the same conversation around race as it pertains to the racial disparities between black and white or any ethnicity and white people in the city.
Majestic Lane is the Deputy Chief of Staff for Mayor Bill Peduto. He's also the Acting Urban Affairs Officer for the City of Pittsburgh. Majestic, thanks so much for being here today.
Thank you.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski, still ahead on The Confluence. The opening of several roads yesterday will provide public access to Hazelwood Green for the first time in more than a century. Then, federal agriculture officials have proposed stricter work requirements for people who receive food stamps. So how will these proposed changes affect Pennsylvanians? Get conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of The Confluence at wesa.fm/confluence.
Marvin Gaye had a rough childhood. Born the son of an abusive preacher 80 years ago today, he avoided his troubled home by singing in doo-wop groups and even running away to join the army. After being discovered by Harvey Fuqua of the Moonglows, Gaye helped to develop the sound of Motown Records in the 1960s with hits like How Sweet It Is to Be Loved by You and I Heard It Through the Grapevine, though his personal life remained a bit messy. In 1971, Marvin Gaye released his opus, What's Going On?, told through the eyes of a Vietnam veteran. Gaye was killed by his father during an argument just one day before his 45th birthday. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spehar.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. Pennsylvania Attorney General Josh Shapiro has sued UPMC to force it to give in-network care to customers of one of the region's largest insurers. If this legal action is unsuccessful, come July, thousands of Western Pennsylvanians must choose between keeping their UPMC doctors or their Highmark health insurance. UPMC claims its competitive relationship with Highmark and the Allegheny Health Network has given consumers more options. 90.5 WESA's Sarah Bowden has details.
UPMC and Highmark are both integrated health systems in that they provide both health care and insurance. It's true that in the past decade, these rivals have each dramatically expanded medical services. But if you ask Maddie Barkley about Lebanon, none of that matters if patients don't have in-network access, something she found out a couple years ago.
He was sitting in that recliner there, having what I thought was a stroke.
Barkley's late husband, Glenn, was actually having a seizure.
Arms extended, rigid, breathing hard.
Emergency responders took Glenn to UPMC Mercy, where he was diagnosed with the same kind of incurable brain cancer that killed Senator John McCain. About a week after arriving at UPMC Mercy, Barkley says staff strongly recommended that Glenn be treated by a doctor at UPMC Shadyside's Hillman Cancer Center, a nationally recognized facility. The Mercy staff also advised that Glenn not make an appointment, but rather go straight to Shadyside's ER.
Because I think in some respects, without telling us, they knew if you come in through the emergency room, they have to take care of you. And I think that that's what they were hoping would happen.
But Barkley says when they arrived at Shadyside, a nonprofit hospital, they were turned away because Glenn had Highmark insurance.
How can you do that? How do you do that?
It is against the law for a hospital to deny care to someone who's having a medical emergency. But Glenn was told he was stable enough that his very aggressive brain cancer didn't qualify as a crisis. The Barkleys eventually found an oncologist and neurosurgeon in the Highmark network who cared for Glenn until he died in January of last year. Barkley says Glenn would have died regardless of where he got treatment, but she's upset by the way UPMC turned her husband away as it caused unnecessary stress and fear. Martin Gaynor is a healthcare economist at Carnegie Mellon University. Gaynor says Barkley's experience isn't unique.
UPMC has engaged in a number of acts that are both very aggressive, as I said, appear to be almost gratuitously cruel.
According to testimony collected by Allegheny County Controller Chelsea Wagner, the Barkleys aren't alone in getting the cold shoulder from UPMC. UPMC declined an interview for this story and says it can't comment on the situation with Glenn Barkley due to patient privacy laws, though UPMC did send a written statement saying that its role in the insurance market has provided consumers more choices. Here's Martin Gaynor.
There's a lot of research evidence that more competition in healthcare markets leads to lower prices. There's also evidence that quality of care is better where healthcare providers face more competition. That's also true with regard to health insurance premiums, that they're lower.
But Gaynor says it appears UPMC is trying to leverage its larger provider network to draw insurance consumers away from Highmark, thereby crushing the competition. But Highmark says it's in a strong position. John Loughborough, who directs member engagement at Highmark, says his company's health system, Allegheny Health Network, is capable of handling even the most complex medical cases.
The Allegheny Health Network is easily one of the best systems on the East Coast, maybe one of the best in the nation.
Highmark has said in the past that it wants its customers to have choice in providers. And Loughborough adds that, despite the impending split, the customer retention rate at Highmark Insurance has been 96%. But one person it's lost is Maddie Barkley. She decided to switch her insurance to UPMC.
If some particular kind of illness befalls me, who's going to have the most likely option of care? And right now it is UPMC.
So even though Barkley has felt mistreated by UPMC, she still left Highmark. And that's what industry watchers say UPMC hoped consumers would do all along. I'm Sarah Bowden, 90.5 WESA News.
WESA receives funding from UPMC and Highmark. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Hazelwood Green site opened to the public Monday, featuring a multi-use bike path and sidewalks aimed at making crucial connections between Hazelwood and surrounding communities. Margaret J. Krause is WESA's development and transportation reporter. Hello, Margaret.
Good morning, Kevin.
All right, so exactly, what's this connection doing for the public?
Sure. So cars can use it, pedestrians can use it, cyclists can use it. Although right now with a car, I don't know how effective it would be to scoot from Hazelwood through the site over to 2nd Avenue again. But largely what it does is it provides a way for pedestrians and cyclists to get from Hazelwood safely to the south side and then on to, say, downtown if you want to, or up into Oakland. Because Irvine Street was really the only egress point. And Irvine Street's a very busy road.
All right. So was it strictly that it was congested, or was it roundabout? I mean, before this, I mean, what were some of the obstacles, roadblocks, if you would, for getting around that area?
Sure. Not so much roundabout. Irvine Street's a very nice direct route, which is why traffic often travels far faster than the posted 25 miles per hour. Some of the sidewalks, property owners have allowed things to come up, problems there, and there's sidewalk only on the inbound toward Hazelwood as opposed to on the outbound. There's less sidewalk access.
Okay. So what's this going to mean? Okay, I live in Hazelwood. I'm a resident there. What is this connection, the latest development in Hazelwood Green, going to mean for me as a resident?
Well, I don't want to speak for all residents, but a couple of things come to mind.
Right.
One is that For a long time, Hazelwood's business district, likely since J&L closed down the steel mill, has not seen much of it as much of an influx of business. It's harder for businesses to stay in business. That's turned around over the last few years, but it connects the business district to this development. So Hazelwood Avenue, which already existed, extends into the Hazelwood Green site. And Blair Street, same thing, extends in. So it's very much the foundations that own the site and the planners working on the site say it's important that Hazelwood Green not be separate from the neighborhood, but rather be a part of the neighborhood.
Wasn't that one of the original concerns? You're going to have this huge development, 178-acre site. Are you truly going to be connected to the community, to the traditional business district? Because we have seen that in other communities where it's been separated with new developments.
Right. And I think, for instance, you could look at the South Side and say South Side Works doesn't take away from the businesses on East Carson. There's still a lot of individual mom and pop shops on East Carson. And what's at South Side Works are larger businesses, larger corporations. And same on Second Avenue and in Hazelwood Green, the idea is that Hazelwood Green will provide different businesses than what's on Second Avenue.
Mm-hmm. Does this improve safety? I mean, you're a bike rider. I mean, yeah. I mean, you are. I mean, I don't think you're not ashamed of it.
Oh,
and
no.
We're not breaking any news here. But you're a bike rider. Does this improve safety for bike riders?
It is terrifying to bike on Second Avenue.
Okay.
And on Irvine Street. It's just, cars are going very quickly. It is a very direct route. It goes over to the Glenwood Bridge. It's when you're not in Hazelwood itself, it's a terrifying experience. And if you're a pedestrian, you're kind of out of luck. So the hope is that from officials say, yes, that this will improve safety. This is a way to be, if you're on a bike, completely separated from car traffic. Mm-hmm. You can go from Gloucester Avenue in Hazelwood all the way to the South Side and hop on the Great Allegheny Passage or the Three Rivers Trail, and you never have to encounter a car. So for younger people, people with families, older people, whoever, you have now a way where you don't have to tango with traffic.
All right. Access. I want to talk access. Does this give access to the riverfront, though?
Well, it eventually, yes. So there is this trail, but the Hazelwood Green site, I talked with Rebecca Flora, who is the planner, the master planner on the site yesterday, and they got a state grant for $160,000 to begin planning for the riverfront section of the site. But so, yeah, you can see the river from the trail, but you can't go down to the river. That's not happening just yet.
Okay. Next steps, I want to talk to you a little bit about the Mill 19 building. Is that still due to open this spring?
The first phase. The first phase, which is the ARM Institute, Carnegie Mellon, Advanced Robotics and Manufacturing Institute, they expect to apply for a temporary occupancy permit and hopefully get that in May to take occupancy.
Mm-hmm. And there are three distinct districts in this whole Hazelwood Green. Briefly remind us, what are their purposes, each of the three?
Sure. So there's the Mill District, the Flats District, and the Riverfront District. The Mill District has this public plaza that's 2 acres that will go, hopefully it's supposed to open in October. It has the Mill 19 building, which is three phases. As we said, one is supposed to open or be occupied this late spring. Phase two is under construction. But the Mill District is light industrial manufacturing. It's mixed use, so retail as well as some other sort of heavier uses.
Mm-hmm.
And then housing in flats and riverfront. It depends what the planning says there.
Mm-hmm. We have about a minute left. Do all the districts, in a sense, have public elements to them?
Yes. So I should have mentioned as well, the 57 from the Port Authority has already been routed to make stops in Hazelwood Green, which is a first in terms of a development that already is served by transit. The public plaza, which is going to be worked on this summer and hopefully open in the fall, is the first of a number of public areas. And all of the development blocks, roughly 2/3 by the summer, they plan to open more streets, will have public access. We'll have these publicly, what's that called? you can maneuver through the site on public land.
Right. And very briefly, the public plaza, is this sort of a gathering place?
It's supposed to be for the neighborhood, for the site. It's going to have a number of planned programmed areas and activities so that it's for everyone.
So for, go ahead.
For the public. But I want to, it's still a construction site. So Hazelwood Green is still very much an active construction zone. So the roads are public. You can be on the cycle track. But the posted signs actually mean please don't go here because there's heavy work going on.
All right. Margaret J. Krause is WESA's development and transportation reporter. Thanks so much, Margaret.
Thanks, Kevin.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Megan Harris. Federal agriculture officials have proposed adding stricter work requirements for people who receive food stamps. These are folks ages 18 to 49 who don't receive disability assistance and don't have dependent children in their household. About 80,000 such people reside in the Commonwealth, and many of those could lose their food assistance if this Trump administration-backed change does take effect. Ann Sanders strongly opposes the proposal. She's the public policy advocate for the Southside-based anti-hunger group Just Harvest. And welcome to The Confluence.
Thanks for having me.
From your vantage point with Just Harvest, how many people in the Pittsburgh area stand to lose out here?
So within Allegheny County, there are about 1,900 individuals whose benefits we put at risk because of this rule.
Who are they? What do their lives look like?
So generally speaking, this is a group of people that's very poor because they're working fewer than 20 hours a week and they don't have access to any other benefit program. Their income is less than half of the poverty line. Disproportionately, these are younger people who are new to the workforce. They don't have connections to jobs that guarantee more than 20 hours a week.
For those less familiar with the SNAP program itself, what sort of assistance does it cover?
So the program, it's most commonly known as food stamps. It comes on like a plastic card that works like a debit card, and it can only be used to purchase food items and not prepared food items. So it has to be something that you would normally buy. It doesn't cover pet food. It doesn't cover toiletries, things like that.
And no diapers, no formula, no feminine hygiene products.
Correct.
Many folks who do receive SNAP are already subject to a work requirement. They have to hit that 20-hour per week limit, or their assistance stops after 3 months. Until now, Pennsylvania has had this waiver system, but this proposed change would drop that flexibility. Is that right?
Yes, that's basically what it does. The rule's designed to limit state flexibility in what areas they waive.
So how does the flexibility work at present, and what would this do?
So currently, the waiver allows states to waive any area where the unemployment rate is more than 20% higher than the national average. And they get to define the area however they choose. So whatever economic region they decide to choose. And this new rule doesn't let them have any of that flexibility. The unemployment rate has to be 7% or higher, which is very, very high. We barely reached over that during the recession in some areas. And it would have to be the area, the state doesn't get to choose areas. It have to be like county or the Census Bureau's metropolitan statistical area.
So here in the Pittsburgh region, who would actually qualify for this?
So right now, well, actually, if you look at Western Pennsylvania broadly, almost all of Western Pennsylvania is waived. Under this rule, only Newcastle City and McKeesport City would still be able to be waived.
That seems like a pretty small subsection of the population.
Yes.
What about other smaller areas like Braddock or Rankin? Where do they fall in this conversation?
So Allegheny County is unique in that we have 138 municipalities. The Census Bureau doesn't calculate unemployment rates for all of them. So the unemployment rate there could be 7% or more, but we don't know, so they can't say, look at this data set and we should waive this region.
So under the proposed change, even if you live in a severely socioeconomically challenged region, Duquesne is another example, you may not qualify for this.
Exactly.
Federal officials have argued a stricter work requirement would provide, quote, assistance through difficult times, but not lifelong dependency. What do you say to that?
Well, the idea that it's lifelong dependency is not based on any fact. The average recipient only uses it for 8 months. So it's not like people are using this for stretches of years and years and years. And most people that can work do work. The people that are affected by this rule, generally speaking, are working part-time jobs, and they may have a month where their hours go under 80 hours that month. Or maybe they just are using it in between jobs, but they might take a month or two to get a job. And the way this rule works is it's every 3 months. So if you use up, say, like a month in January and then a month in February and then a month in August, the next month that you don't have 80 hours, you're not going to have assistance. So it's like when you need it the most, it won't be there.
On the flip side, critics say this effectively punishes people who may want to work but just can't find anything, that it's more likely to hurt veterans or people who are recently incarcerated. Just Harvest, I assume, falls on this side?
Yes. Basically, this rule hurts any group that have a harder time getting a job. So if you have a criminal history, if you don't own a car. So any group of people that maybe only have a high school degree or didn't finish high school, they're going to be affected by this.
Just Harvest has held comment periods for people. What are you hearing from folks out in the community?
So a lot of folks are worried about their friends, family. A lot of people, when you think of like people that don't have kids and are single, there's a stereotype of like it's a single man who's like in this own isolated little world or whatever. But that's not really the case. Half of the people are women. And most of them have children, but maybe they don't have full custody of the child. They split custody. They're connected to family members. And so if they don't have access to the benefit, their family's looking, thinking, oh, I'm going to have to help take care of this person. And I'm also struggling. How am I going to do that?
You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Megan Harris talking to Ann Sanders of Just Harvest about a proposed change that would put more strict work requirements on people who receive SNAP or food stamp benefits. And Pennsylvania's State Department of Human Services is also opposed. Are you working together on messaging, or is there flexibility for some kind of counterproposal?
So the state is submitting their own comment because they are opposed to it also. The administration firmly believes that voluntary programs that they've been investing in is the best use of their resources rather than these mandatory programs that, historically speaking, haven't worked to help people connect to meaningful jobs. So they are also sending in comments to oppose this rule. There's also a letter that 47 U.S. senators have signed on to opposing the rule also.
That's right. A couple Republicans, but 44 are Democrats, including Senator Bob Casey of Pennsylvania. And so at Just Harvest, will you be submitting a comment of your own?
Yes, we will.
Can concerned Pittsburghers still add to that? Can they get in touch?
Yes. So actually, if you go to our website at justharvest.org, there's a link and you can go there. There's a little bit of more detailed information about the rule and a link to where you can submit the comment. The deadline is midnight tonight.
And we'll have a link to that on our website, wesa.fm. And do you think lawmakers have a strong understanding of what it means to people who rely on this assistance?
I think once you explain to people if people can't work, they lose their benefit, then people realize like, oh, this isn't a good idea. People need the assistance. A lot of times people just stop at the if people can work, they should work mentality, which I think that's kind of like a disconnect there.
Threats to SNAP benefits, of course, aren't new to our culture. When you're going back and looking at precedent, what does that tell you about the current fight?
It's interesting because both Republican and Democratic governors have all used this waiver, and it kind of goes back and forth between what's partisan and not partisan. I think that the work requirement thing has become sort of a hot topic where, you know, you see them trying to impose this on Medicaid and impose it more strictly on SNAP, and time and again, the majority of people come out and say it's important that people access these vital benefits.
Does that access point feel more important than, you know, making sure that someone is quote unquote deserving of help?
And that's the phrase that no one wants to say is deserving or undeserving, right? But that's kind of what these policies do is they label someone as saying, well, you don't deserve the help because you're not doing X, Y, Z. And the worst thing about these policies is that a lot of people are doing the right things. They just don't have the documents to prove it. Documentation is the biggest barrier for all recipients of these programs, regardless of situation. And what these policies do is create extra paperwork for everybody.
Ann Sanders is the public policy advocate at Just Harvest. Ann, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Megan Harris. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's election day in the 37th state Senate district. Residents in the airport area and some of the South Hills choosing a state senator to replace Guy Reschenthaler, who entered the U.S. House in January. It's Democrat Pam Iovino against Republican Dee Raja. WESA's politics and government accountability editor Chris Potter is in studio. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Kevin.
All right. Republicans still hold a comfortable edge in the state Senate at this time. So even if Pam Iovino pulls out a victory, does it matter much?
Well, yeah, in the short term, not really. I think the advantage is 26 to 21 with three vacancies, including this one. So, yeah, nothing's going to change control of that House. And, of course, the House of Representatives is also in Republican hands. But Democrats will tell you if they can win this seat, and they feel optimistic about that, that does set them up for 2020 when there'll be some other competitive seats, including one in Erie. And then this seat, again, will be up for grabs. So the winner will have to run again to hold their seat just next year. The other thing that a lot of people are sort of paying attention to is these suburban communities, which are kind of the swingy areas in the American electorate now. How will they go? How are the people feeling? What kind of messages resonate with those voters? And people are kind of keeping an eye on it for those reasons as well, for what it tells us about the election to come.
Has the 37th been a traditional Republican stronghold? You've been covering politics in this region for quite some time.
Yeah, I think in my history as somebody who paid any attention to this stuff at all, there's only been one Democrat who has held the seat, and it was Matt Smith, and he didn't even stick around for a full term. I think he stayed around for half of his term. And then he left, and Guy Reschenthaler won in his special. Now Guy Reschenthaler is off on his way. So yeah, it has generally been a Republican, affluent Republican, suburban community. Communities make up the bulk of this district, although we're seeing a lot of that change, especially in the era of Trump.
All right. So would you say, therefore, if indeed it has been a Republican stronghold, you know, I don't know if you'd use the term safe seat, but a fairly safe seat, would this be an upset if Pam Iovino won?
I don't, you know, maybe in a different, if you'd asked somebody a year ago how this seat would fare, maybe they would say so. I think we're in a different environment, though, now, right now. I mean, as I said before, the suburban votes are very much up for grabs in this era of Donald Trump in particular. Donald Trump and the national GOP, the brand is kind of souring with a certain kind of Republican, a college-educated, professional-class Republican who doesn't like a lot of what they're kind of hearing nationally. But at this lower House level, at these lower races down ballot for state legislatures in particular, Republicans have held on. We saw that in 2018. A lot of these communities voted for Bob Casey for Senate. They voted for Tom Wolf for governor. But then they voted for Republican candidates to hold on to these seats when it came to state House races in particular. So that's what Democrats are up against. I expect this to be a fairly close race here today.
All right. What sort of voter turnout are you expecting? How much interest is there?
You know, that's always hard to say. I think a safe bet would be around 20% turnout just based on sort of historical records and stuff like that. Democrats, I live in the district. I've seen a lot of grassroots activity by Democrats in particular. So there's interest amongst the partisan activist base. We'll see how voters feel.
Any big names, you know, higher up in the party been campaigning at all or not?
Yeah, Connor Lamb has been whose special election win just this time a year ago was a big deal in this same community. He's been out there in particular. A lot of the Democrats especially have been active on Pam Iovino's behalf. Raja has drawn less support from him. Harrisburg publicly. He has definitely had endorsements. There's been some money coming from party apparatus, but he hasn't had that kind of star power coming in and showing up for him.
Pundits often look at special elections to see if they might point to things to come. So what might we glean from this that could inform 2020?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the big tests today is how the abortion issue plays. In the wake of the state of New York basically eased some requirements involving the means by which a woman could obtain a late-term abortion, Republicans nationally and in this race have really seized on that. They're trying to make Democrats look like the champions of late-term abortions, as opposed to people who just believe that it's a medical procedure that is sometimes necessary and should be protected. The Raja campaign has gone very hard with its TV ads trying to portray Iovino as a supporter of that. We will see if it works. And this may be, I think, the first race where, since New York passed its law and since Virginia kind of dithered with a law, where that has become a political issue, and we'll see how it plays out, because I think a lot of people expect this to be kind of a preview of what we'll see in 2020 on that issue.
And very briefly, any other issue might linger for 2020?
It's hard to say. I mean, I think in Pennsylvania, you know, the severance tax continues to be an issue that divides the parties, and we see that continuously and probably will till the end of time.
Okay. Chris Potters, the leader of WESA's Government and Accountability Team. Thanks so much, Chris.
Thank you.
And stay tuned to 90.5 WESA for the results of today's special election. For today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, a conversation with award-winning New York Times correspondent Maggie Haberman about her long history reporting on Donald Trump. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, production assistance by Mick Stanelli, Julia Zenkovich, and Alex Lenigan. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.